So let me just make sure. Can you hear me okay back there? Yeah? Okay, good. It's very nice to be here. I'll tell you a story that illustrates why this particular subject is important to me. I've been a practicing psychotherapist since 1970, and around, I guess it was about 1963-64, I was in the library at in Belmont, and I had an addiction to science fiction books. And so I basically was going through all of the science fiction books, first A, then B, then C, and I was headed for my my favorite corner. And as I got to about where the science fiction books were, a book dropped off the shelf and landed in my arms. And I looked at it, and the the first word that I saw was taboo. And I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. Wow, something that I'm not supposed to be reading. And I'm about 17 years old at the point, so I'm figuring, well, it's probably got sex in it somewhere. And so I looked at the subject line. The title of the book was "The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are," by Alan Watts. And I decided to check it out. So I took it out of the library, and I felt a little bit like I was a practicing Jew. I grew up in a family where it was very important to attend Sunday school. I taught Sunday school to younger kids. And so it was a little bit like having like a brown wrappered book, you know, that I was bringing into my my home. It was like contraband. I couldn't even explain what it was, but I knew it wasn't Jewish. And so I started reading it, and couple of things that really stood out to me in the book. One was that we have these constructed false ideas of who we are. And that was not a foreign concept to me, because I felt myself to be very alienated from most of the kids that I knew. I did not have a good experience in high school, mostly because I just didn't fit in at all. Like a lot of kids, but certainly I knew what he was talking about when he was talking about, well, you put together some idea of yourself so that you can survive. And then a second thing that really stood out to me was that there was a practice that could help you train your mind. And one of the things that really appealed to me about that was that growing up in a Jewish family and being very familiar with kind of Judeo-Christian approach to religion, I didn't find a whole lot in Judaism that I could call skill-based. The rabbi who I studied with, who I love very, very deeply, kind of resorted to a lot of, well, it just is the way that it is. Take it on faith. And being, 17 and not really wanting to take anything on faith, it didn't satisfy me. And so I saw this phrase that Buddhism was a not a religion, but a set of practices, something that one could accumulate in the way of skills. And that stuck with me. So fast forward. I'm now a practicing psychotherapist, and I have had about a four-year hiatus between the time that I was introduced to Alan Watts and the next event. The next event was that a friend of mine invited me to go to a ceremony that the Karmapa was doing in Fort Mason. So this was 1971. And as some of you know, the Karmapa is the head of the another lineage. The Dalai Lama is the head of a lineage in Tibetan Buddhism. The Karmapa is the head of a lineage. And so I thought, well, this is really interesting. You know, I've never really seen anybody who's a holy man in Buddhism, and so I'll go. And there were about 2,500 people in the Fort Mason. This was the Black Hat Ceremony, and the I don't know if it was the tagline, but the notion was that if you witness this ceremony, you get off the wheel of suffering. I thought, well, that's I'm up for that. Because I knew I was suffering. And so I went to this event, and I don't know if any of you have been to Tibetan Buddhist events, but they're at least 2 hours late. It's fashionable amongst, you know, the higher you are in the hierarchy, the longer you wait for them. And so we were sitting there, you know, and by this time there were probably about 400 kids that were in this ceremony, and they were just running wild and, you know, running around and making all kinds of noise. It was becoming quite chaotic. And there was a moment just before the door opened when every kid that was up and around just sat down. There was no signal. Nobody said anything. They just all silenced and sat down. And then the Karmapa walked in. And there was this palpable presence that he brought with him. It was like, you know, instead of having this long train behind you if you're the king or queen, he had this long train of energy that kind of preceded him into the room. And I'm kind of a skeptic, and I'm looking at this guy, and there's these beads of energy that are coming off of him, and I thought, I'm going to listen to him. There's something going on here. And so I sat through it. It was a very powerful event, and that led me to being very interested in Tibetan Buddhism and beginning to study a little bit the teachings of the Dalai Lama. At this point, my psychotherapy practice and my beginning kind of foray into Buddhism really were quite separate. I didn't see them as really anything that I particularly wanted to integrate. But what began to happen was that some of the ways that I was getting trained in the retreats or, you know, the sittings was beginning to have an effect on my practice, my psychotherapy practice. And one of the first ways that it began to affect me was that, well, two things. One was that as a psychotherapist, you have a tendency to start owning your client's problems. It's called countertransference, which is a fancy name for it's your problem, it's now my problem. And so what I'd find is that I couldn't sleep at night. I'd be thinking about the problems that people were bringing to me, and I was trying to work them through in my mind and then present a solution. And it was quite trying. It was actually beginning to burn me out. And I'd only been practicing for a very short time as a psychotherapist, and I was already thinking about what else could I be doing. And the second effect that it had was that I had begun to get introduced to mindfulness. And I realized pretty early on that that sitting with clients is a form of mindfulness, and that really, if I was really truly serving the clients I was working with, that all that I had to do was to give my full undivided attention to whoever sat in front of me for an hour, and that would be sufficient. And anything else that you might add to that in the way of wisdom or knowledge or experience is icing on the cake. The most important thing is presence. And so that began a search for me in integrating Buddhism and psychotherapy. So what I'd like to do tonight is to talk about the contribution that Buddhism has made to Western psychology. And first and foremost, as the Dalai Lama will say over and over again, that the foundation of Buddhism is the alleviation of suffering. That more than anything else, that what Buddhism is really about is identifying that there is suffering and that there is a solution or a pathway out of suffering, and that the pathway out has to do with training. It's not, for me, for somebody who has a very hard time with think and grow rich and the Abraham school of, you know, intended and it will happen, you know, because I think that there are a lot of things that happen to people that are, who knows why they happen, you know, and to claim it and say, well, you did it, to me is a little bit arrogant. I'm kind of more interested in just simply training my mind. That's what I'm interested in. And I find that as a result of training my mind and working with my emotions, that I could say that over the last 40 years, that a lot of my suffering is gone. So let me start with a poem from Hafiz. And Hafiz was a mystic, a poet, and had a lot to say about our relationship to ourselves. This is called We Have Not Come to Take Prisoners. We have not come here to take prisoners, but to surrender ever more deeply to freedom and joy. We have not come into this exquisite world to hold ourselves hostage from love. Run, my dear, run from anything that may not strengthen your precious budding wings. Run like hell, my dear, from anyone likely to put a sharp knife into the sacred, tender vision of your beautiful heart. We have a duty to befriend those aspects of obedience that stand outside of our house and shout to our reason, oh please, come out and play. For we have not come here to take prisoners or to confine our wondrous spirits, but to experience ever and ever more deeply our divine courage, freedom, and light. That's from Hafiz. So there are three ways to consider the influence that Buddhism has had on psychology. And we could group those three. First of all, phenomenology, which is the description of reality. So if you look at any religion, or if you look at any culture, if you look at any group of people, a tribe, they have a way of thinking about reality. And, you know, some views on reality are such that they're nihilistic, so that the view is that there is no reality, there is no substance. Some views on reality are substantial in that this body that we have, this world that we live in, this is it. Buddhism has a very interesting perspective about phenomenology in that it has a middle view. And the middle view is that there are two truths. One truth is considered the universal truth, and that universal truth is insubstantial, meaning that there is no self. And we could talk about that for, you know, the entire evening, but suffice it to say that there is no place that we can point to and say that is the self. So on one hand, we have the universal view, and then on the other is that we also happen to have these bodies, and that we are here on earth, and that we're dealing with a certain kind of law of existence that has to do with, if you drop a pencil, it falls to the ground. If you don't take care of your body, it gets ill. If you treat people badly, it tends to come back at you in certain kinds of ways. This is the relative truth. And so in Buddhism, the view of reality is that one walks the path of really being ambidextrous. That on one hand, we understand that we are connected to this universal, and on the other, we're also trying to apply that universal to our daily existence. So that's the phenomenological view. The second way that Buddhism has affected Western thought and Western psychology is on what we consider in psychology as transformation and healing. And this is particularly relevant because up until very, very recently, psychotherapy was influenced by a medical model of pathology. If you went to a psychotherapist, the psychotherapist was trained in a worldview that could be summarized as, what's wrong with this picture? This person who's sitting across from me, I know they're screwed up. So let me just figure out which way it is. Let me help them diagnose it, and then let me help them put up with it. That's a version of transformation and healing. It doesn't happen to be particularly satisfying to me, but it is one that a lot of my colleagues are limited by. Buddhism has had this extraordinary impact on psychotherapy, and one of the ways that it's affected psychotherapy is that it's been a influence on what's now called positive psychology. So how many of you are familiar with the term positive psychology, have read about it or are familiar with it? So if you go on the web and you just put in the search line positive psychology, you'll find thousands of references to psychologists and researchers who are exploring what's right about human beings. What's good about us? What works? Where are our strengths? Where are our gifts? How do we use the talents that we bring in? And what's very interesting is that if you come from that perspective as a psychotherapist, your clients tend to get better much quicker, as you can imagine. So the second way that Buddhism has affected Western psychology is in our notion of transformation and healing. You might say that there is more optimism on the part of a psychotherapist who has a practice in Buddhism because there's an understanding that the possibilities of transformation and healing are limitless. And of course, this is being borne out by the research on neuroplasticity, where we're now having research or empirical evidence that the brain is plastic and that it's not fixed, and that we are capable of learning new habits and ridding ourselves of others. The third, and then I'm going to stop for a moment and just see if you have any comments or questions. The third area that we could look at is the clinical utility of Buddhism. How many of you are familiar with the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn? Anybody know Jon Kabat-Zinn? So many of you do. If you were to do nothing else out of tonight's talk and you wanted to educate yourself further, I would suggest that you go to Jon Kabat-Zinn, Z-I-N-N. So his last name is K-A-B-A-T-Z-I-N-N. And just look at what he has to say about what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR. So Jon Kabat-Zinn is the founder of MBSR, and it was in response, the development of MBSR was in response to his experience as a physician, observing the suffering that people were experiencing with chronic pain, with cancer, with heart disease, and asking, is there some utilitarian way to use my Buddhist practice to help people who were dealing with chronic ailments? And he developed this model, and now, after 33 years, there are 15,000 hospitals and medical clinics throughout the world that have a regular program of MBSR. The National Institute of Health last year called MBSR the most exciting non-medical interventive model in the last decade. MBSR is used in medicine, but it's also used extensively in psychotherapy, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. So let me just open it up and see if there are any comments or any questions so far. Anything anybody would like to say, please.
You just said the word non-something.
Non-medically interventive. So what that means is that it's non-invasive. MBSR is non-invasive, right. Yeah, it's like there's no surgery, there's no pills. It's a way of working with, well, let me give you a specific example. So one way that MBSR is used is in pain management. This was the original discovery of Jon Kabat-Zinn, that it could have a tremendous impact on chronic pain. And so up until very recently, the only real treatment methods for chronic pain were surgery, pill medication. That's about it. Kabat-Zinn proved that if you were willing to just face the pain, if you were willing to meditate on the pain, look at the pain, observe the pain, that what began to happen was that the pain would begin to diminish. And that you could actually manage the intensity of that pain just simply by your attention. Other questions, clarification, comments? Anybody? Yes, please. And speak up, I'm hard of hearing.
Are you talking about physical pain and emotional
pain? Both. Yes. And I'll come back to that when I start talking about some of the uses of psychotherapy and MBSR. So what they first began to develop were methodologies for working with physical pain. But of course, what they discovered very quickly was that you couldn't really separate the mind and the body. That was a Western medical notion or a philosophic notion, and that what you do with the mind affects the body, and what you do with the body affects the mind. Yes, please.
So this, in a sense, confirms what in quantum physics we say, that the observed changes as we observe.
Yes. Yes. In fact, there is no way that you can separate the observer from the observed.
I know the body work, psychology connected to that.
Yes. Yep. Good. Anybody else before I move on? Okay, thanks. So, let me just continue. So, how many of you are aware that both Freud and Jung studied Buddhism? Anybody know that? One of the things about Jung is that when you think about the impact that Carl Jung has on psychology, we know a lot about Jung's impact on dreams, what he said about symbolism, mythology, but what is less well known is that Jung was a cross-cultural anthropologist. And what I mean by that is that he was interested in looking into every culture in the world and asking the question, what can we learn from Asia? What can we learn from Africa? What can we learn in terms of psychological theory? And he came across the writings of the Buddha, and it had a profound effect on some of his thinking, especially in the application of the use of concentration. So one of the things that he became interested in was what happens when somebody gives their full undivided attention to anything. And Freud, on the other hand, was more of a rather than an applications-oriented kind of person, he was more interested in the philosophy behind Buddhism. And in Civilization and Discontent, which was one of his last books, he said that he was only hopeful about the effect that Asian philosophy might have on Western civilization and the possibility that we might be able to use the advanced and older views of cultures that have been around for thousands of years. So very, very early on, you can begin to see some of the impact that Buddhism is having on some of the early theorists. As many of you know, there's kind of a three-legged stool to Buddhism's practice. And the first area that is often introduced is the ethics or the ethical stance in Buddhism. A Welsh psychologist named Rhys Davids was very interested in ethical Buddhism. She felt that one of the reasons why people go crazy is because they lead lives that are primarily pursuits of either greed or hatred. And she said that, in her opinion, we would find out many years later that we could trace back all psychopathology, all diseases of the mind, to states of mind that, unless we are able to begin to relate to them in a different way than just simply being motivated by them, that we would basically kind of run amok as a civilization. So she became interested in the Abhidhamma as a researcher. So kind of skipping forward and looking at some of the more kind of contemporary effects of Buddhism, as early as the late 1960s, what began to happen was that as Rick Fields stated, the swan had come to the lake. And what he was referring to was the first contact that Buddhism was beginning to have with popular culture. So until the 60s, what you saw were very erudite researchers who were having contact with Buddhist thinkers, Buddhist scholars, Buddhist luminaries, and writing about it in very esoteric journals. It wasn't yet something that was beginning to kind of enter the mainstream of Western thought. But that changed dramatically as a result of Suzuki Roshi. And if some of you are old enough to remember this, you know, some of you may remember the early days of the Haight-Ashbury and the beginnings of the kind of recognition amongst many who were dabbling in hallucinogenics that there might be actually a way to go up and stay there. You know, as Ram Dass said, you can get high, but it's legal, and you don't come down if you meditate. And I think that one of the streams in Western psychology is the kind of beginning experimenting with states of consciousness that you found either as a result of people embracing Zen Buddhism and or Tibetan Buddhism, or being attracted to some other form of Buddhism that was less well known. As many of you know, mindfulness, Vipassana, really came upon the scene really more in the early 70s. So the kind of early approach in Western psychology really was through Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. But ultimately, whether it was because people were interested in experimenting with states of mind, ultimately the question always becomes, what's the utilitarian value of Buddhism? You know, if you're Jon Kabat-Zinn and you're a practitioner of Buddhism, one of the things as a physician that you're trained to think about in the Hippocratic Oath is, how do I help people stop suffering? And so what began to happen in the 70s was that there became an applied field of psychology and Buddhism. And you began to see people really writing about, thinking about, and talking about at conferences, what is it that we can find in this you know, kind of interesting, curious area called Buddhism. And I'd like to just read another Hafiz poem that I thought was particularly relevant to this notion of suffering. This could have been written to anyone who's ever experienced mental suffering. So this is called Crooked Deals. There's a madman inside of you who's always running for office. Why vote him in? For he never keeps the accounts straight. He gets all kinds of crooked deals happening all over town that will just give you a big headache. And glue your kisser a gigantic, confused frown. and glue to your kisser a gigantic, confused frown. So one of the early reasons why Buddhism was particularly of value to me, and it was the first way that I began to apply it, is that I'm an addict. And I thought, well, I could just say, well, you know, I'm a recovering addict, and Buddhism happens to be one of my tools. And it would be true. And in 1970, somewhere between 1970 and 1972, I went through a transformation that had as a consequence three visible, tangible outcomes. Number one, I stopped smoking forever. Number two, about a year after this transformation, I gave up my daily use of marijuana. And number three, I lost 100 pounds and have kept it off for 40 years. And the only thing, you know, if you're a scientist, you're always looking at, is there a cause and effect relationship, and what are the factors or variables that might have been inside of this change? Well, in November of 1970, I was 300 pounds, smoking three packs of cigarettes a day, using alcohol alcoholically, and smoking marijuana on a daily basis. It was all attempts to try to deal with the suffering that I felt mentally, emotionally. And none of them worked. And well, that's not true. They worked for short periods of time. I mean, let's face it, any addict who's sitting here knows these things work. But the problem was that it would always end up becoming more pain, and then I'd have to use more. So that was the condition leading up to Thanksgiving of 1970. And then a very close friend of mine invited me to a three-day sit, a sitting meditation that had two components to it. One of them was that it was a Zen sesshin, so we were sitting Zen, Zazen. And the other was that we were every 45 minutes breaking out of Zazen and using a dyad, using a one-on-one communication technique to answer the question, who am I? So you'd meditate on the question, who am I? And then whatever you generated, whatever got generated as a result of that, you would communicate, and then you'd go back into Zazen. It was a very interesting process that really combined kind of Eastern and Western technology. I went through that 3 days, and on the other side of that 3 days, I discovered 3 weeks later that I was now a non-smoker. I just forgot that I smoked. I also found that the marijuana and alcohol habit had become really uninteresting. That instead of getting high, I was getting low. Or at least I was getting lower than I was when I was meditating. And then the weight began to drop off because I just didn't need the food anymore. There was no purpose to it. And so as a result of that experience, for about 3 years, I kept on asking anybody that I could find who knew anything about psychotherapy, what happened? I mean, I was curious. I mean, it's very hard to understand how you would go through such a radical transformation. And, you know, I didn't do Oprah's diet. She wasn't even doing it at that point. I hadn't gone to AA yet. I hadn't gone to the 12-step programs. But something had intervened. And I figured out that what had intervened was that I had begun this practice of getting to know my own mind. And up until that point, my mind was a bad neighborhood that I wanted to spend no time in at all. I was very good at distracting myself. But now, after going through this meditation practice, I began to become very curious about my own mind. I began to watch it. And in the early days, I remember very clearly just being appalled on an hourly, minute-by-minute, daily basis at how crazy it was. You know, I began to have this language of that there was an observer or a fair witness that was watching the machinations of my mind. I couldn't do anything about it yet. I just knew that that wasn't who I was, that there was some separation there. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I guess what happened was that I figured out what my life's work was. It was very clear to me, even in the early stages, that I really was interested in the application of Buddhism. I love practicing. I take a great delight at studying with the people at Spirit Rock, with Shyla, with whoever happens to be somebody available to study with. But ultimately, the thing that I'm most interested in is, so what? What can you do with it? So I want to tell you a little story that illustrates kind of why I continue to practice. So this weekend was the weekend from hell. My wife and I had this project, and the project entailed hiring someone to do some work for us. And we had, interviewed a bunch of people, and we'd arrived at this guy we loved. We just thought, this guy is really going to do a great job. We can work with him. And so we were scheduled to meet with him at 10 o'clock on Saturday and start the work. And he gets out of his truck and he walks over and he says, I can't do the work. And once you're in the execution phase of a project, you don't want to be told by somebody that you're now back to square one, right? So I'm listening to this. So my ears are hearing what he's saying. My mind and my emotions immediately went into deep dissatisfaction. Like, okay, life is really terrible. And now your whole life is going to be about, having to do this all over again. I mean, it was really interesting watching the downward spiral of my emotional state while at the same time being able to stay present and just talk to him and, commiserate with why he couldn't do it. It was out of his control. He handled it like a gentleman. And so now I've got this kind of binary vision that's going on. On one hand, I'm going into, as they say, the man cave. I'm going into my cave, and I am now cutting off contact with my wife. I don't want to talk to her. I'm in what's called an upset. And I'm also watching it at the same time. And then the day, the morning goes on, and my wife, who's chronically optimistic, going, well, we'll figure it out. Something better will, take its place. And I know enough, because I've been through this enough times with my habitual mind, to know that it just takes me time to work this through. And the way that I work it through is I grouse a lot. I complain bitterly about how unfair it is. But I know my mind well enough to know that it does that. And so I'm kind of watching the movie. I've got this internal story going on about how unfair it is and, what a burden this is going to now be. And meanwhile, I'm also problem solving and kind of going, well, so we'll just figure it out. It'll work out. And then later in the day, we go to lunch and then come back. And we find that we've been locked out of our house. And which is, it's not particularly a terrible thing, except that being able to continue to kind of work on this project required that we be inside the house. And so now we're stranded And we can't do anything more. And it's now about 104 degrees, right? You know, it's very hot. And my body and my mind are accelerating their screaming at me about how terrible life is and how much there is to be dissatisfied about. Now, let me just ask a question. Honestly, is there anybody else here who has ever experienced any of this? Please tell me I'm not the only one. Okay, thank God. All right. Whew. So, you know, I thought, well, I can do what I usually do. So my mother, who is a very wise soul, said to me one time, she said, when things go wrong, you become like a bull. And that's my nature, is that if things are going south, I'm going to try to drag them north. And so one part of me is like determined and willful, and we're going to get this solved by the end of the afternoon. And the other part of me is going, just pay attention to what's going on. Just pay attention. The energy is not moving in the direction that you want it to move. Why not just relax? Just observe it. And so we agreed that we would do nothing more on it, and that instead we would just let it go. We'd say like, okay, tomorrow we'll come back to it after we've had a good meal and that we've had a chance to, you know, kind of sit on it. 2 years ago, 5 years ago, that's not what I'd be doing. You know, today is Tuesday, I'd still be in an upset. It would just continue. You know, because I, like all of us, I have habitual mind states that are very difficult to detach from. And one of them, which I think is kind of common, is that once desire has been triggered and it's really, the knob of desire is really turned up, it's really hard to turn it down. And so I was observing that I had a lot of desire, a lot of intention, a lot of will aimed at solving this problem, and that it was very clear from the way that things were turning out that it wasn't the right time, that it would be better to relax. Now, for me, I look at that, and that did not happen as a result of a guru hitting me on the nose. That didn't happen as a result of, you know, sitting in a human potential seminar and being screamed at. It happened, the reason why there's a difference in the way I react is because every day I sit down and I do 45 minutes of sitting. And that 2 times a year I go to at least a 7-day silent retreat. And that almost every day I do metta practice. And I'll tell you, you know, those of you that are not familiar with the term metta, it means loving kindness. And in the last 2 years, I almost died. I mean, I came very close to death this last year. As a result of a very bitter divorce, I have lost contact with my 3 daughters who have been extremely important to me. I was a great dad. And they've just been alienated by the whole divorce process. And I could be bitter. I mean, it certainly would be one option, and a very attractive option, because you can always find several people who will collude with you in your bitterness and tell you why you should really hate her or why you should never speak to these 3 children again. But instead, because I have this practice called metta, loving kindness, what I do every day is I visualize all of them, and I wish them health and happiness, and that they be free of internal and external suffering. And occasionally I'll throw in, I wish you'd wake up. Because I still, like you, have anger. It doesn't go away forever. There were times when I was in this near-death experience, which went on for almost 4 months, when the only thing I could do, I couldn't sleep at all for weeks at a time, And the only thing I could do was to get up in the middle of the night and just go out my door and do walking meditation. Just put one foot in front of the other and then just pick up the other one. Because basically I couldn't walk any faster than that. I was so weak. So I thought, well, that's what's going on. So you might as well just do it as a practice. So I'd be walking around Mountain View, 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, I thought, well, if I ever get picked up by the police, I have a great story. You know, whether it's believable or not, I don't know, but I at least have a story. So last thing I want to just talk about is Buddhist practice in clinical settings. So I have a couple of things I'd like to say about psychotherapy. One of them is there are many, many good psychotherapists who are not Buddhists. So I don't want to make an assertion that the only good therapists are practicing Buddhists or that they're practicing mindfulness. The other thing, the flip side of that is that there are a lot of bad therapists and a lot of them are mindless. And you can tell. You know, they fall asleep on you. They forget your name. They ask you the same question that they asked 3 weeks ago. And so one direct way that I would talk about the impact that Buddhism has had is that there are a lot of really well-trained therapists who also happen to be very mindful. And if therapy ever becomes something that you find yourself wanting, I recommend that you interview the therapist and find out if they have a practice. And do they do it? Because some people have practices, but they don't do them. Mindfulness has found its way into the treatment of many mental health disorders. So, for example, there's a woman named Marsha Linehan who founded something that's called dialectical behavioral therapy, or DBT. DBT is the treatment of choice for people who have personality disorders. Historically, people who were diagnosed with personality disorders like narcissism were considered untreatable. And Linehan has demonstrated that using mindfulness in combination with good therapy can help people who have very severe narcissistic personalities, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. It's beginning to be used for many areas. A second area that has become a wonderful area of innovation for mindfulness is in the treatment of anxiety and any cognitive disorder or thought disorder. CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, was founded by Albert Ellis. Ellis was a closet Buddhist. He was very interested in Buddhist practice, became one of the early exponents of mindfulness before it was called mindfulness. So this even preceded John Kabat-Zinn. But he was noted for telling his clients to develop an observer to their mind so that they begin to realize that their mind had these habits and that these habits could be changed, first of all, by observation, and second of all, by what he called cognitive restructuring. If you go on the web and you look at Buddhism's impact on psychotherapy, there are hundreds and hundreds of examples, notably in the field of addiction. One of the great convergence, I think, is in the 12-step programs and the adoption of mindfulness practice. So, for example, are any of you familiar with the group Dharma Punks? Anybody ever heard of Dharma Punks? So, for young addicts, there's a group that are called Dharma Punks that were founded by what's his first name? Noah Levine. And so Noah is a young man, recovering heroin addict, a Buddhist practitioner in 12-step programs, done a wonderful job of integrating the 12-step programs and Buddhism for Young People. There's another author, Griffith. What's his first name? Last name's Griffith. And he's written a book on the 12 step. It's called Breath by One Breath at a Time, for people who are interested in the integration of the 12 step programs and Buddhist practice. He's a regular teacher at Spirit Rock. And if you go on the web and you look for Buddhist Recovery Network, you'll find tremendous amount of writing now of people who are talking about this. I think personally that as we, you know, kind of continue, we'll keep on seeing new innovations in the field of psychotherapy because of Buddhism. How many of you have ever heard of emotional intelligence? How many of you know that Daniel Goleman, who is the founder of emotional intelligence, was the person who brought the Dalai Lama to America in 1968 to the University of Wisconsin? First time that the Dalai Lama ever came to the United States, it was a result of a doctor of psychology whose name was Daniel Goleman, who was already beginning to experiment with the integration of Buddhism into Western psychology. He calls it emotional intelligence. And if you look at the 24 skills that he lists in his book on emotional intelligence, you'll note that many of them have to do with the developing of attention. So let me just read a final poem, and then we'll just see if there's any comments or questions that anybody would like to ask. So those of you that are familiar with the poet Kabir probably have heard this read. So the reference in the poem to the guest is the reference to our own observer, the self. Friend, hope for the guest while you are alive. Jump into experience while you are alive. Think and think while you are alive. What you call salvation belongs to the time before death. If you don't break your ropes while you're alive, do you think ghosts will do it after? The idea that the soul will join with the ecstatic just because the body is rotten, that's all fantasy. What is found now is found then. What is found now is found then. If you find nothing now, you will simply end up with an apartment in the city of death. If you make love with the divine now, in the next life, you will have the face of satisfied desire. So plunge into the truth. Find out who the teacher is. Believe in the great sound. Kabir says this: when the guest is being searched for, it is the intensity of the longing for the guest that does all the work. Look at me, and you will see a slave of that intensity. So why don't we just take a moment and just sit in silence and appreciate each other in silence.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.